Today's programming is made possible by the Beckman Cafe, inside the Beckman Center on the U of I campus. The Beckman Cafe offers a daily selection of breakfast items, hot lunch entrees, made-to-order espresso drinks, and frozen yogurt. Soup and vegetarian fare are available daily. Open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The Beckman Cafe, where great minds eat. www.beckman.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Sandy Mason is our guest. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month she stops by here and we talk about lawn and garden care, things that grow in the home landscape, houseplants too, any and all of that is certainly welcome. If you want to give us a call, maybe you have a problem and you're not quite sure how to deal with it. Maybe you are still at this point thinking about what you might like to plant and you're looking for some suggestions. Any and all of that is certainly fine, and I know that Sandy would do her very best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And that's the number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that toll-free line. Otherwise, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Good morning.
I think you did a recent column about watering.
Yeah.
And
it
was
rained
thinking,
that day,
and then
I think.
Well,
I thought I should have written that earlier.
Sure rained like heck here last night. So, yeah. But I guess, and Ed Kieser, our meteorologist, said it, here at the radio station, we got last night 1.8 inches.
Wow.
And I would bet that came in about an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
And although he did also say that within our listening area, people may be listening to us, there may still be places where they have not gotten rain.
Wow, that's
and it
scary.
Has been, you know, over the last 6 weeks, it has been quite dry. We didn't get anywhere near our average for May, and then until the big rain yesterday, I think here in Champaign-Urbana, we had less than half an inch total.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the kind of thing that I'm sure if you're a farmer and you haven't gotten rain, you're concerned. And of course, if you're a gardener, and you're also going to be concerned too. Generally, for those people who still have now not gotten rain, and it looks like probably if you didn't, it's going to be maybe at least another week before we'd expect significant rain. How do you think about watering and making sure you do take care of the plants in your home landscape?
Yeah. I think you almost have to do a sort of a triage kind of thing. You know, think of those plants. I think, number one, I think of those plants that you just put in, obviously, anything that was just put in this year, and especially trees and shrubs, because if you think about it, trees and shrubs are generally a little harder sometimes to replace, maybe a little bit more expensive to replace. So I think probably first of all, I'd think of trees and shrubs, and I'd also think of trees and shrubs, even if I just put them in, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. You know, we think, you know, after a year, oh, it's established, don't worry about it. But even, you know, even the first 3 years of a tree or shrub's life, you still need to water them. We'd like to see about, you know, kind of rule of thumb, but it's going to vary from how much soil, what kind of soil you have and that kind of thing. But usually we think about an inch of water a week would be really nice to have. And what we'd like to see is sort of this slow watering, not this inch in an hour kind of thing that you were talking about. Right. What would be nice if it was a slow one. So if you could use drip irrigation, something that's very efficient, the sprinklers that we think of, you know, that are fun to play in, you know, when you're a kid, but it really pretty inefficient way to watering, unless you're doing obviously lawns, which makes it much more difficult. But for trees, shrubs, perennials, I think about, you know, drip irrigation, soaker hoses, those kinds of things, very efficient way to do your watering. So I think about those. And then, of course, anything, any kind of perennials, those kind of things that you put in this year, I would certainly start thinking about those. If you have vegetables, when they start to form whatever thing that you're going to be eating, you know, whether it's tomatoes or whatever, or even fruits, blueberries are just now starting to really start to get to the point where they're getting some size to them. They need water now. So when they're producing that fruit, whatever we're eating, that's when they're going to need water. Again, you know, inch of water a week would be a sort of a good place to start there. So, you know, it's really kind of tough when you have to start making these decisions on what gets watered and what doesn't.
Yeah. I know that I heard somewhere someone talking about the recommendations for lawns. The fact that, or at least it's the way that I remember it, that once, if you have a really prolonged dry period and the grass goes dormant, which is its natural thing to do, that it's probably better just to leave it because rather than water, unless you're going to water very consistently, because it doesn't like to go through cycles of being wet and then being dry.
Right. Absolutely. And I know that usually what happens is, you know, it starts to go brown, so people start to water, and then they get their water bill for that month. And so you think of the water bill, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. And so you quit watering, it goes brown again. And that cycling back and forth actually uses up a lot of the food reserves for the plant, and that's not what you're wanting it to do. So it's much better off if you can just let it go dormant. Now, you can do some water if you're afraid it's absolutely going to die. You know, if you can give it maybe a fourth of an inch, a half an inch every couple of weeks, it's not going to green up with that, but it more than likely will stay alive. So if you're just absolutely concerned about that. But as you said, with Kentucky bluegrass or our cool season grasses, that's what they do normally. Hot, dry, they go dormant. When we start getting cooler weather and more water, then they'll green up. So you have to make that decision, either let it go dry and go dormant or water on a consistent basis.
Okay. Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone calling on a cell phone. They're in Lovington. We'll go right there, line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a farmer, and I also have a vegetable garden, and I'm concerned about Asian rust on soybeans, and I'm also concerned about it, wondering, will it hit my green beans in the garden and also tomatoes? And if it will, what do you recommend to spray for it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an excellent question. Really, at this point, as far as we know, it will move to other legumes. So things like green beans or anything in sort of that bean family, there's certainly a chance that it might move to that. I think at this point, we're kind of more than likely, or it's going to show up on soybeans first because we have more acreage of soybeans. It's going to show up there first. And so I think at that point, then we can start making some thoughts and suggestions on green beans and some of the other what would be considered sort of minor crops, ones that we don't have a lot of acreage in. So I think right now it'd be much more of a concern on soybeans, and we'll kind of wait and see to see how extensive it gets. And hopefully we won't see it this year, but you don't know. So it's a good question, and I think it may be a problem in the future that we'll have to think about on green beans and some of the other ones. But I guarantee you, if you're a farmer, it's going to show up on some of the other crops first.
Well, I definitely will agree with that, and I hear it's the hurricane that just came up and the rain this last weekend may or may not have brought spores with
it.
So.
Yep. You're absolutely right, and that's the big concern now, that with those, when we start getting these storms, it's very easy for those fungal spores to move in on storms. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go on. And we have someone now here in town, Champaign-Urbana. Champaign, specifically, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hi. I have a question regarding mums. My mums are starting to bloom right now.
Mm-hmm.
If I let them bloom, will they still bloom in the fall, or should I cut them back now if I want them to bloom in the fall?
So these are ones that have been in there for a while?
Yeah, they've been in a few years now.
Yeah.
And I've always cut them back about this time every summer.
Right.
I'm just wondering, do I really need to be cutting them back?
Well, usually we cut them back just to make them more compact and to produce more flowers.
Okay.
So it's and you're seeing one of the effects of not pinching them back or cutting them back is that they will flower earlier.
Uh-huh.
So you just happen to have one of those varieties of flower earlier. This is pretty much going to be its big shot for the most part. So if you're really wanting it later on in the season, I'd probably go ahead and pinch it back.
Okay, and if I let them bloom, then I won't have...
More than likely, you won't see it again.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
for this year at least.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
All right, thank you for the call. Again, our number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And our guest for this hour is Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension in Champaign County. She's here every month, always on a Tuesday, and we talk about things that grow in the home landscape. We have a couple of Chicago listeners this morning, so we'll go first to line four right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
If a plant dies in a pot of old age, is the soil in that pot worth keeping, or does it wear out?
And I guess I'll ask, how do you know it died of old age?
Well, most things, you get tired of it or something like that. And you tend to save the dirt to the soil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or, I guess... I guess not really knowing why it died necessarily, I would be a little reluctant if I thought that maybe it had some root rot diseases or something that might, you know, carry over in the soil. And in that case, in that case, you can pasteurize the soil if you want to. You can put it on your Weber grill outside, and if you get a thermometer and put the thermometer in there, we want it at 180 degrees for at least 30 minutes, and that'll pasteurize the soil, and you can certainly reuse it then.
What's your opinion of the soil that you buy in the supermarket? Mm-hmm. Is that fresh stuff?
Well, it kind of depends. There's, you know, lots of them out there. I think the ones, some of them you just sort of have to get used to. There are a lot of soilless mixes now that people may or may not be terribly familiar with. There's no soil in there. It's, you know, peat moss, vermiculite, those kinds of things. And they're good products in that they drain very well, so they're good for containers. But you have to kind of get used to making sure that you do water them fairly consistently, too. So they hold on to moisture, but yeah, they drain well. So usually it works out pretty good for containers. But if there's no fertilizer in there, realize there's no soil in there either, so there's no natural fertilizer in there. So you have to be more consistent when it comes to fertilization with those soilless mixes. You have to really pay attention to that. The other things I guess I'd worry a little bit about is that I wouldn't use topsoil in a container unless you have pasteurized it. If it just says topsoil, that's good for your garden situation, not real great for containers. The other kind of potting soils, you really kind of get what you pay for in those potting soils. If you open the bag and it's all black, like soil, but then there's like three little pieces of perlite in it, that's just not enough to really add the drainage that we need. So you really need that you know, well-drained soil, because you start putting soils in containers, they act very, very differently than if they're out in a garden situation. The drainage changes, the whole dynamic changes of the watering system. So you kind of have to look at what kind of plants you have. You can certainly buy potting soil, add your own perlite if you want to. So it kind of depends on, you know, what you want to work with and what kind of plants you have, maybe. Does that help?
Well, some say don't use perlite. Why is that?
Well, it depends on the plant. So there are some plants that actually have problems with perlite because of higher pHs. Sometimes perlite can be a problem with those, and so often they'll say just use vermiculite and you don't have to worry about it.
Right.
And some people don't like perlite because it's white and sometimes it kind of floats to the top, so sometimes it's just a personal preference. You can certainly use vermiculite in place of perlite if you want to go that route, too.
All right, then. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to another Chicago caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I have a stand of pachysandra under a maple tree in front of my house. And are you there?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Part of it is old, which has been around the tree for a while, and then I expanded it and put like $100 worth of pachysandra plants around it. Well, this spring... they all, you know, fell over dead, the new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might be a fungus. I took it up to the botanic garden, and they actually came up with a fungus called Volutella.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it kind of swept through all these new plants, which were gorgeous when I put them in. So I'm wondering now what to do with this stand. Actually, last year I had a minor problem with it, and I pulled those plants out before I planted the new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, what can I do now?
Did they mention a fungicide for you? It'd have to be something you'd use as a preventative.
Okay.
But you can use fungicides for those.
Okay,
as well.
So just some any regular kind.
Well, I'm trying to think of what might be a good one there. Probably just one of the all-purpose ones.
Okay.
Probably something like a Daconil or one of those. I would just look for an all-purpose sort of fungicide for ornamental plants.
And I have to put that in a sprayer? Or does it come in a spray bottle? Or
You're probably going to have to mix it. I think most of I shouldn't say that. Some of those are ready to use. I shouldn't necessarily say that.
Okay.
So some of them are ready to use. But many of them you have to have your own sprayer, and then you mix it up. But it is something you're going to have to use as a preventative on those.
Also, last winter, I let the leaves from the maple tree, you know, remain there, and I thought that would be a good mulch. Well, I wondered if that was a good idea or not.
Yeah, the problem is, especially with maple leaves, they have a tendency to mat down, and so they make it very moist underneath them, and that may have been part of the problem, to be honest with you. It keeps in all that moisture, and that's just perfect for funguses.
So I'll just rake them out this
year. Yeah, so that might have been part of the issue there, but sometimes it's an environmental thing as well. So.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Bye. Back here to Urbana, line number 2, I believe. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I bought a hydrangea this year, and it's the kind that will bloom a blue flower if you have aluminum sulfate. So what I did was when I first planted it, I mixed up some soil with some aluminum sulfate, just a little bit in it. I planted it, and now I have these nice blue blooms coming out. But what I was wondering is if I should fertilize it maybe later in the summer and mix some more aluminum sulfide in the water when I, because right now I'm just watering it every couple of days with just plain water. So I don't know how long the soil is going to hold that aluminum that I put in when I first planted it. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, it's pretty much something you have to add on a regular basis, I will tell you.
Okay.
Yeah, it's something that they need on a regular basis. So I would certainly think about that, especially if it's a new planting.
Yeah. So like once a week when I water the other stuff in the pots?
Yeah, or, you know, you could even go with some of just the acid-loving fertilizers if you want to go that route. Again, it's another one of those that, you know, you don't want to do a lot of fertilization unless you're also doing watering.
Yeah, well, I water it every day because I noticed it droops. Like when we had that dry spell, it needed water every day. So that's not a problem. I don't mind. But I was just wondering if I needed to eventually add some more aluminum sulfate to keep the blue flowers.
Right. Okay. You definitely need to think about that. And as you found out, hydrangeas are kind of water hogs. You kind of have to really watch them. They have a tendency to dry out pretty fast.
Okay.
Good
thanks
luck.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Well, you know, now that's very interesting because I have a hydrangea that has been in the ground now, I think, maybe 3 years. And this is the first time it's flowered and it's flowering. Mm-hmm. And the flowers are white. And I was looking at that flower and I was thinking, you know, I thought for sure that that was supposed to be a blue flower. Mm-hmm. On this plant. Now, maybe I'm just wrong and that it was not supposed to be a blue flower, but I thought it was really curious. So how do you know?
Well, there are certainly some white hydrangeas that are out there, and those are the big snowball ones, and those are by far the easiest ones, I would say, to grow because they're pretty tough plants, and they bloom on new wood, so you never have to worry about if they die back in the wintertime or whatever. The pink-blue ones, although there's some new varieties now that actually bloom on new and old wood, generally if it's not blue and you thought it was supposed to be blue, it'll still have a pink tinge to it. If it's pure white, I wonder if you don't really have one of the white hydrangeas, because usually it's one of those that it goes blue or it goes bluish pink or to pink, but I haven't seen really pure white in those that are supposed to be blue or pink, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll have to take a closer look and see. This was a plant that I was beginning to wonder whether it was ever going to flower. And this year, it really looks good. It's certainly the best that it has looked. And because, you know, we've talked about this before and you've talked about their need for water, this was one plant in particular I was trying this spring to make sure got plenty of water. And it seems to be pretty happy. And it is now making flowers. But I thought this was supposed to be blue.
Well, you could try using some aluminum sulfate just to see if you can coax it into at least some color there. But generally, if it's pure white, I'd say that's its job, is to be pure
be
white.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That's
white's
okay.
Pretty.
It's fine. Oh, I was happy to see it flowering, and I told it how pretty it was. I've been telling everything.
Encouragement.
And I've been telling everything how pretty they all are, and they seem to be doing okay. So, you know, maybe that works. I don't know. Mansfield is next, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have 3 questions, I think. Number 1 is, I read in the Chicago Tribune this weekend that it's all right to cut daffodil foliage off around Father's Day. And I was wondering if that applies to the foliage, because I put out a lot of bulbs last fall. And some of the foliage is, you know, of course, dead and brown, but some is still green and looks well.
It really is one of those things. Father's Day is probably pretty good rule of thumb, but if it's still green, I'd leave it on there.
Okay.
I know you're probably getting tired of it maybe at this point, but you know, the idea is, you know, that's how the plant produces more food reserves for next year. So the longer you leave those leaves on, the better off you are. But once they start to yellow And obviously start to die down naturally. You can certainly take them off at that point. But I've noticed the other day I have some daffodils, some later flowering daffodils. Mm-hmm. The foliage still looks great.
Yeah, so. That's what I was wondering. I was ready to cut it all off. Okay, and the second thing is I planted a new shrub rose this year, and I was wondering if I fertilize it on the same schedule as my older roses.
The older as in like tea roses? Or
This is a shrub rose, but I have just tea roses besides. Mm-hmm.
Generally with shrub roses, you certainly can, and it's not going to hurt them. Mm-hmm. Most of the time with the shrub roses, they start to get almost too big, depending on where you have them. So I'm not sure I'd necessarily encourage a lot of extra growth on those things, to be honest with you, because we treat them more as shrubs, you know, and we leave them fairly big. Usually people leave them fairly big. So I would certainly fertilize it, and they'll certainly respond to fertilization, but I think I'd probably hold back and not fertilize them quite as often as the other ones.
Okay. And then I've listened with interest to all the Creeping Charlie conversations, and I am still waging war, and I'm ahead. But I just wondered, the Creeping Charlie that has come up near in my new bed near some plants, is it safe on a windless day to spray gently the Creeping Charlie, and will that affect the plant with Roundup?
And that's fine, as long as you don't get it on anything you want to keep.
Okay.
And obviously, as you said, you want to do it on a windless day and just make sure that you protect the other plants and make sure that they don't get sprayed. But it certainly can be used for that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help.
Good luck.
Very good. Thank you. We will continue. And next in line, I believe, is a caller in Champaign. And line number two. Hello.
Yes, we planted a red twig dogwood shrub about 3 weeks ago, and now it's dropping a lot of leaves. They're turning yellow and dropping from the lower part of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's an issue like houseplants, and you can tell me whether I'm correct on that or not. Lower leaves dropping off is an overwatering root rot problem. Would that happen?
Not necessarily, but... I think, you know, those are pretty tough shrubs. Were you able to water it after you planted it?
We did, yeah.
Red twigs are such tough plants that they will tolerate even really wet soils.
Okay.
If it was another plant, then I'd say, maybe there's some issues there. But, you know, I've seen them sitting, you know, right next to ponds and almost in streams. So too much watering doesn't seem to be a big issue for them. You know, I wonder if, you know, was that about the time we were getting those hot, dry winds and a lot of things going on?
I suppose. Whatever we've had for the last 3 weeks.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if it's just an environmental thing and just the fact that it's a new transplant. So, I think about watering it, you know, on a fairly regular basis, maybe a couple times a week or whatever, and then kind of go from there. But, you know, just check the soil. That's really your best bet when knowing whether to water or not. You know, dig down a little bit and kind of get an idea of how often you have to water it to make sure that the soil's moist.
Okay. And can you talk a little bit about the root rot and houseplant-ish issue?
Yeah, you know, oftentimes we'll actually see some of the newer growth will die back because it tends to be, you know, the newer growth tends to have the most need for water, you know, because it's producing new leaves and the whole thing. So a lot of times we'll see that newer growth die back. But that'll also happen if it's too dry. So that's the problem sometimes with yellowing leaves. You kind of have to, you know, be a detective and figure out, well, it's not too much water. Maybe it's not enough. So you kind of, because unfortunately a lot of the symptoms look very similar.
Okay.
So,
okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. To next caller here, which should be line number three, and this is also someone in Champaign.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about a shrub rose.
Mm-hmm.
Several years ago, a friend of mine gave me two beautiful shrub roses and planted them in my those whiskey tubs in front of my house, and they are now just huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what the best time is to transplant them. And I thought about trying to do it in the fall, but I wasn't sure how much I could cut them back in order to make them reasonable to transplant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't sure what the best approach was because they are about 4 feet across now. So
you're going to have to get out your leather gear, I think, to transplant
those. So prickly. They're beautiful, and I want to save them and transplant them, but I'm just not sure what to do.
Right. And I think actually spring or fall, when I say fall, I'm really talking more like September. I wouldn't wait much later than that.
Because they don't die back until like November.
Right, absolutely, but that's fine. Because by September, we're getting into a little, hopefully, moister weather, cooler weather. And because you really want them to maintain. I wouldn't cut it back unless you just truly have to cut it back just to physically, because you can't manhandle them any other way.
Yeah.
I would just leave all those stems on there, because those are all food reserves, and all those leaves are all ways that that plant can help to recover after the transplant. So I would move it and then leave all that on there and just let it, you know, do what it needs to do to get ready for winter, or wait until next spring and do it about April or so and then move it at that time.
Oh, okay, but September is fine.
Yeah, September will be fine, sure.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, and just make sure you water it, obviously, after you've transplanted it.
Right, because it does live quite late into the frost.
Sure, which is actually great, because hopefully it'll have time to recover
from
the transplant.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
All right, to line number one next, and this is also Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate your show. I have a problem with my lawn. The owner of the house before me had some chives planted, and it went on and infested a lot of places in the lawn.
Mm.
I first tried with a little Roundup. It killed the grass, but not the chives.
Not exactly the thing you wanted.
So I thought I'll take it all and just plant it all over again. But
yeah.
It's a very tough plant.
You're absolutely right.
Is there any solution to that other than pulling one by one for the whole lawn?
Yeah, I don't. I think there might be something that a commercial lawn care company might be able to get a hold of that would be specific for that kind of plant, but I don't think there's anything out there for homeowners that that you could use yourself. So unfortunately,
something for bulbs in general.
And that's the problem. You know, it'll Roundup or whatever, it might kill off the top, but they just don't kill off that little bulb. And so until you get rid of that little bulb thing that's underneath, they're real hard to get rid of. Obviously, as you.
Even if you pull them out and keep them outside, they stay for about 4 or 5 days alive. And
oh, I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
It's yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you need to come up with lots of recipes for chives.
I guess. But it tastes like grass. That's the problem.
Yeah. But unfortunately, there just isn't anything. They're so closely, related to some extent to grasses that it's very difficult to have an herbicide that's going to select for them and not also kill your grass. So unfortunately, we don't really have a lot of those things available. But you might, if you have a lawn care service or want to think about a lawn care service, you might check with one of them.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
all
tough.
Right. We'll go on here to another Champagne person. This is line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. We had great success growing PJM rhododendrons in our front entryway, which is north-facing and rather airless, sort of enclosed. And at one point, this very large, beautiful one died. And every replacement we have put in there has not made it past 2 years. I am wondering what it almost seems as if there's poison in the soil that kills them. And I'm wondering what we might, how you might diagnose that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with rhododendrons and azaleas in general is that they can get a root rot problem. And unfortunately, it is one of those things where you may see certain branches die back over a period of time and they sort of slowly decline or maybe quickly decline, depending on how it is. So I'd wonder a little bit about some of the root rot problems, because certainly if you had one that died from that, then that particular fungus population is a little bit higher in that area. So if one tends to go under stress because it's too wet or too dry, then it's much more susceptible to that fungus that's already there, if that makes sense. You're absolutely right. There could be a problem there simply because of that.
Is there a way to get rid of that fungus?
There are some fungicide drenches or some fungicides that you could use for those.
Mm-hmm.
And right off the top of my head, I can't really think of which ones you'd be looking for. But I would just go into any of the garden centers and ask them for a fungicide you'd use for some of the root rot problems. I can't think of what is labeled for rhododendrons right off the top of my head. But,
okay, great. I will ask about that. I have a second question.
Mm-hmm.
We have very large river birches, which have been suffering from chlorosis.
Mm-hmm.
We have had iron put into the trunks, the spikes into the trunks, and then we've had iron scattered around the ground underneath. And we're kind of at a loss. They're already starting to yellow now, mid-June. And I wondered, is there anything else we could do?
Mm-hmm. Now, they don't also have spots on the leaves, too, do they? Or do they?
Not yet.
Okay. Because they do get a leaf spot disease that will cause the leaves to yellow and fall off, too. But it goes a general yellow, whereas chlorosis, chlorosis tends to be yellow in between the veins, and the veins stay green.
That's right. That's what this is.
Yeah, that's iron deficiency, which is you found out. I guess it's kind of the same thing, even along the lines of what the rhododendron is. You know, anytime they go under these stresses, whether it's, you know, too hot for the most part or too dry, then these things start to show up even more.
Yeah.
So if there's any way you can water, I would also think, I'm not sure what they're using on the soil, but make sure it's something that's called a chelated iron, something that makes it more available to the plant. Also thinking about acid-loving fertilizers, which is exactly what I'd also be thinking about with the rhododendrons. You want the problem is around here, our pHs of our soils are just too high. They like an acidic soil, and we just don't really have it. And so they suffer from these iron deficiencies, rhododendrons and birches both. So if you can think about those kinds of things, if there's, depending on what they're putting on, to make sure that they're actually doing something to acidify the soil as well, rather than just putting iron on, if that makes sense.
Okay, good. That makes lots of sense.
Yeah, and watering is going to be a big, you know, they're river birches. They like that, or birches in general, just like that more moisture soil.
Okay, wonderful.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for the call. We have as our guest here this morning on Focus 580, Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Every month on a Tuesday, she's here. We talk about lawn and garden care, and whatever questions you have, I know she'll do her best to help you out. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Another Champaign caller here, line one. Hello.
You may have answered this question when you talked about rhododendrons a second ago, but I have a rhododendron that's looking very yellow. It's in the ground. I think it's a third season. It's bloomed one blossom over that time. What can I do about that?
Yeah. It sounds like you may be in the same kind of boat. I don't know. When you planted it, did you add any sulfur or anything to help reduce the pH?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. You know, I think rhododendrons and azaleas are absolutely beautiful plants, but I think they're definitely one of those plants, just like blueberries, that we really have to think, you know, maybe even a year or a season before we plant them. They need that low pH soil. And so adding sulfur, and you can even do that now. You can actually sprinkle sulfur. It's not as good as actually having it, you know, mixed into the soil, but it'll help. Using acid-loving fertilizers will help. Those kind of things are going to help to green it up. I definitely think about some of the acid loving fertilizers that say that they're good for foliar fertilization.
Okay.
You can, because they tend to green up a little bit faster. Make sure they don't dry out too much, but make sure they don't get too wet.
Okay.
Mulching is also a good thing. You know, it has some wood chip mulch, something like that is good too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
They're one of those, you know, they're beautiful plants, but they're just a little finicky.
Yeah.
You know, they have to have that right soil and all those things to really make them grow well.
Yeah, we have one that we planted, and I think that this has been its second spring when it has flowered, and it's a dwarf variety, so it's still not very big. And I have been using one of these water soluble. I'm a Miracle Grow guy. One of these water soluble fertilizers.
You can admit it.
And I guess one of the things that I have been wondering whether, you know, one of the things we've talked about those fertilizers is they're really good because they work very quickly, but the effect doesn't last very
long.
Absolutely.
You're right.
So I guess one of the things I was wondering, if you're using that kind of fertilizer, how often you can, the packet says you can fertilize as much as once a week.
Right, which you can, because you really, as you say, it's something that you're fertilizing right then, and then, you know, it pretty much doesn't have a whole lot of effect much past that. So it's good and bad. I'd also be thinking about, I would add sulfur. I usually add it twice a year, once in the fall and once in the spring, once in the fall, to help to change that pH of the soil. So you're helping with the fertilizer as sort of a quick fix, but you need to have some more long-term solutions by trying to lower the pH in the soil itself. So by using sulfur or something like that. Sulfur is great, but it's very slow reacting.
And is that something that you can add at the garden center? You're going to find it readily on the shelf.
Right. And it usually comes in a paper package or whatever, and it's sulfur, and it's actually like little chips-like things, what it looks like. And hopefully you'd mix it into the soil like the season before you actually plant the rhododendrons, but we never think about it that far in advance.
No.
So you just, you know, have it on the top surface of the soil.
Okay. So, what other things might like that that kind of fertilizer as opposed to just the general. I like, you know, I've been using their regular stuff, sort of put it on almost anything. It seems to be good for just about almost anything, and sort of a general purpose kind of thing. But I also wonder now, are there other, besides the rhododendron, things like clearly rhododendrons and azaleas, you know, there's these related plants that all like that same kind of thing. What else commonly likes
blueberries,
that?
Although I know people don't always think about them as an ornamental plant. They're actually a very pretty plant, but certainly those would take that. I also even think about, there's some other shrubs out there that people may or may not be familiar with. There's one called Itea that's gotten to be very popular. The Henry Garnet Itea is another one that needs, it'll go yellow, and so you need to make sure that it uses acid-loving fertilizers. There's also another shrub called Summer Sweet Clethra, which is another one, a shrub that's gotten to be more and more popular that needs more of that acid soil. So, you know, there's a few out there, and it'd be good, you know, if you can even plant those fairly close together. They kind of like all the same kind of conditions anyway. So, you know, maybe trying to group some of those plants together can be very helpful. A lot of the perennials will take a wide variety of soils, from acidic to a little bit more alkaline. So, you know, there's no reason why they can't also have some of that acidifying fertilizer too, and not really cause any problems to them.
Okay. Well, we have about 20 minutes, maybe a little bit less, with Sandy, and we'll take as many calls as we can. And the lines are full right at the moment, so we'll plunge back in here. And first person in line is Champagne, and this will be line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. One was about transplanting mature trees.
Mm-hmm.
We actually did this about a couple of years ago in the fall. And they seem to take fairly well, and they suggested that we not fertilize too much, because the idea was that the roots needed to go seeking out. And so if we put the fertilizer too close, you know, to the tree, then they would have no need to go seek it out. So we've done that. But we noticed, even though one is a pear tree, and it blossomed beautifully this spring, but after that, we've noticed that the leaves have really thinned out off mm-hmm. the trees. And I don't know if that's still kind of a transplant shock that they're going through, or if we do need to do some more fertilizing now that they've been in there almost a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, when you say mature, how big were they?
They were about, I think, 20 to 30 years old.
Okay. And then, I assume they used a tree spade, one of the big tree spades.
Oh, yes, right.
Considering a plant that big and then using the tree spade, you know, they obviously suffered a lot of root damage from that. And so I think you're still seeing transplant problems.
Okay.
So I would this would definitely be a plant I'd worry about. I shouldn't say worry about. I would be extra cautious with it for the first 5 years of its life here.
So what we've been doing is we make sure that, especially with the rain, lack of it, we have made sure that we've kept it watered.
Yeah, and that's your best thing to do.
Okay.
By far your best thing to do. And I really wouldn't worry too much about fertilizing it either.
Okay.
To be honest with you.
You
might fertilize, depending on whether you've already fertilized this year. If you hadn't, you might do it this fall, perhaps.
Okay. What we've just done is whatever we've put on the grass, the lawn around it.
Oh,
that's
well, then
all we've done.
I would not do anything extra.
Right, okay.
But I will tell you that have you mulched around it as well?
No.
I would absolutely get the sod. You may not want to hear this, but I'd get the sod away from it.
Really?
You bet.
Why is that?
Well, sod is actually quite a competitor when it comes to fertilizer as well as water. Then they've done plenty of studies, absolutely plenty of studies, looking at tree growth where there's sod underneath it as opposed to when there's mulch underneath it. By far, you get better growth with mulching.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Okay. And you think about it, most of these trees are forested trees. They're used to having, you know, wood mulch and leaves and all this stuff underneath them. They're not used to having grass underneath them.
Okay.
So I'd get that away, and I'd get it at least to the drip line, you know, where the leaves come out.
Right. Okay.
I'd get all that out of there, mulch it with that 3 to 4 inches of wood chip mulch, keep it away from the trunk itself, and then do your watering, and I think that's going to be some of your best
bets. The reason we didn't mulch is because the person who did it for us said that a lot of times what happens is that people do the mulch, but because they're not very good at it, they almost drown it, in a sense, with the mulch, that it just kind of keeps it from getting the nutrients it really needs, just mainly oxygen and stuff, to get down into the trunk and to the tree, because of the mulch can sometimes just overwhelm it. And that was his concern, was that we would not probably do it so well, I guess.
You're by far better off to go ahead and mulch. Just don't do it too deep. You know, don't do these volcano things.
Yeah,
you know?
But that's what we would feed her.
Yeah, you just want 3 or 4 inches of wood chip mulch, and I would say composted wood chip mulch, not the fresh stuff, because that creates a problem. If it's like a tree yesterday and now it's chips, that is not the kind of stuff that you want to use on a tree like that.
So it should just be hardwood mulch.
Yeah, I'd go. Are you here in Champaign?
Yes.
I'd go out to the Landscape Recycling Center on East University. They have great stuff. You can pick out different sizes of, you know, whether you want bigger chips or smaller chips. They actually have a fairly nice product that is a little bit more composted, okay. And that's excellent around trees.
Oh, okay.
You'll get a lot better growth out of it.
Okay. Now, the other question is about a shrub that we put in. It's a bleeding heart. Have you heard of those?
It's a shrub called bleeding heart?
It's a shrub or plant. Right now it looks like a shrub that's overtaking our flower bed.
Okay, because there is a perennial plant called bleeding
plant.
Heart.
Yes, it's a plant. It is a perennial plant.
Uh-huh.
And it's doing extremely well.
They can get big.
Well, we hadn't realized how big it could actually get because we kind of put it in a corner. So now we're wondering just how much we can actually prune off of it and without losing, because it bloomed. It's still blooming, actually.
Yeah,
and we thought it was going to be done, and it just keeps putting out the flowers.
Yeah. No, that's great, because a lot of times when it gets hot and dry, they tend to die back.
Right. Well, we put, we mulch with, in the flower beds, we mulch with cocoa beans.
Oh, uh-huh.
Because of the soil so bad. But then it's just been watering it, and it's just everywhere.
So it's happy.
It's really happy and wants to keep growing. But now we're just wondering how much more can we let it grow before it overtakes everything else in the flower bed.
Yeah. Well, if you want to do some trimming on it, I definitely would not cut it back altogether.
Okay.
Because, they're perennials, and so they need those leaves on there to produce more food reserves for next year.
Right.
I will tell you that bleeding heart, if you decide you want to move it, they're a little bit harder to move because they tend to have a tap root. They're a little bit more finicky when it comes to moving, but if you wanted to, I'd wait until next spring if you decide you really want to move it.
But spring would be the best. Okay.
Right, about April or so.
Okay.
You want to go that route and just decide it's going to be too big for that spot.
Yeah, because we hadn't realized just how big it was, because when we got it, it was a twig, basically.
Yeah. So, well, it's a very happy plant.
It's a very happy plant, but kind of going a little crazy right now.
Too happy.
So better not to prune it at this point.
I would do a slight pruning if you really want to. But
then maybe move it in the spring would be better.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Great.
Right.
Well, thanks so much.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Next is line 3, someone listening in Urbana. Hello.
I've got two barberry bushes side by side. One's a brown or bronze reddish leafed variety, and the other's a green leafed variety. The green leafed shrub has a fair amount of yellow on the leaves, and most of the yellow is, in fact, on one side plant.
Mm-hmm. For some reason, would it have gotten that one gotten wetter for any reason?
That plant has had a sort of a yellowish cast to it for quite a while. It was on the property when we bought the house in 1997.
Mm-hmm. But it's just on one side?
It tends to be more yellow on the south side of the plant.
Okay. Because, there are some of those varieties that tend to be redder, and some of them tend to be more yellow as just a natural thing.
Yeah, I mean, this has a very light green leaf. The Japanese beetles love it in the summertime later on, but
I guess what I'm wondering is if that's not the cultivar, that's just not the variety itself.
Okay,
because some of those tend to be a little bit yellower than others, and that's just their natural. They call it chartreuse. They don't really call it yellow, but they tend to be that kind of chartreusey color, and that's just they've been selected for that. Some people actually like that, so I'm wondering a bit about that. Otherwise, we don't have a whole lot of problems with those guys, other than if it gets too wet. They'll take some dryness, but I suppose if they got really dry, then they might be problems with that. So usually it's like a root injury of some kind from being too wet or something like that might cause more yellowing on one side. But I'd really question if that's not just exactly what it's supposed to be doing.
Okay. And the best time to trim those?
I would probably, you can do some trimming now if they're getting kind of out of control, but I wouldn't do a whole lot of pruning until next spring.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank
okay.
you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll continue. Next up is Matt Toon, line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm calling regarding the vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
I planted lettuce and spinach the last day of February and used that up and put another planting in about a month later, and it's just about gone. I've gone through this routine several years, but the past year or so, I have troubles with the lettuce and spinach on the third planting
mm-hmm.
in late June, July.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I'm doing something wrong or whether the area is really quite shady.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't think that was that much of a disadvantage, but maybe it is.
Well, most of those leafy crops actually can take some shade, so you're absolutely right with that. And actually, in this case, it might actually help them a little bit, but I have a feeling it's more of a heat problem. Is it just they just don't develop well, or they don't germinate well, or when you say they don't do well with that third planting?
Well, that seems to be it. I mean, it's kind of sparse.
Yeah, it's just too hot. To be honest with you, it's, you know, those are really cool season crops. They like that, as you found out. February, hey, good for you. Planting in February, way to go. You're my kind
wet.
Of gardener. So what if it's February?
Wet. I had to kind of practically mud it in.
Yeah, but it still worked, didn't it? So I have a feeling, so what you might want to do, I'm not sure what varieties you're looking at, but I would definitely look, you know, spinach in particular is really tough to get spinach. It tends to bolt really quick, you know, to go to flower really quick when it's hot. But there are some more heat resistant ones. There is a stuff that's not really like spinach, but it's called Malabar spinach. It's supposed to be like spinach. I think it's a little bit more slimy than spinach. So, but it can be used as a spinach replacement until it gets cooler. And then I would look for those lettuce varieties that say they're heat resistant.
Well, they say that. They indicate that.
But then they're still not doing well?
Well, no, I say I don't have seed that indicates.
Yeah, I would absolutely look for those in the catalogs or whatever, and that say heat resistant, and that's, I think that's probably your biggest problem. So you're probably not doing anything wrong. I think it's just the weather.
Well, it could be. I got. Yeah. I thought maybe that I hadn't maybe watered it adequately in summer months.
Yeah, you know, and because they are going to take a lot of water, but yet, you know, they're really one of those that likes that cooler season. And then once it starts to cool off, then you can start replanting again. It's just July and August is tough.
One other question. I had some older leftover seeds, zucchini mm-hmm. and cucumber seeds,
mm-hmm.
and I planted several hills this spring, and I couldn't get anything to come out of it at all.
Yeah.
And I was gone for a number of days, and it didn't get watered, and so I thought, well, maybe that's what it was. But I waited and worked on it. Nothing happened, so I gave up and went out and bought some zucchini plants,
right,
which seemed to be doing very well. Do mm-hmm. seeds, after a year or so, do they dry out? Or
you know, it kind of it depends on how they've been stored. I mean, they like to be cool and dry.
Well, I don't leave them in my shed over the winter.
Well, that's good.
And so they don't have freezing temperatures.
Well, that's good. And they don't like really hot temperatures either. So they certainly can, you know, have a problem, but some seeds you can keep for a long time. Usually what you'll see is the germination rate goes down. So instead of getting, you know, 85% of the seeds will germinate, you're only seeing like 50% of the seeds will germinate. So usually what you end up doing is you have to overplant. You know, instead of planting two or three seeds, you might do six or seven seeds, hoping that, you know, you'll eventually get enough seeds.
I was putting six to eight in each hill and then thin them out.
Well, what you might want to do in the future, you can sort of test it out. You can just take a paper towel, you know, put like 10 seeds or so in there, roll it up, put it in a plastic bag, wet it down a little bit, and then just put it someplace warm for a couple of days, and then you'll see if they're going to germinate or not. And then you won't have to. And then if none of them germinate, you'll say, "Well, those seeds aren't any good." And then you won't waste your time on those old seeds.
Well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
All right, thank you. We'll keep going. We'll go here next to Champagne. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I have a question about a shrub, three shrubs that I planted this spring: cotton aster or cotone aster. I'm not quite sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think you got it right the second time.
Yeah, cotone aster.
Cotone
uh-huh.
aster.
Cotone aster.
Yeah, it looks like cotton aster.
I planted one in a very small space, Do they grow very big? Should I transplant it?
Yeah, the trouble with that question is there's many different kinds of cotoneasters.
Right.
And some of them are actually fairly large shrubs, and some of them tend to sort of, you know, flow along the soil almost like a ground cover.
Right. And should I have them planted by the wall? I see them an awful lot in Europe. I seldom see them here. And they're so beautiful in mm-hmm. the fall when they're red and orange and gorgeous.
Right. We do grow them around here. Probably the one that we see the most often is that mounding type that's fairly short but very wide. And that's probably the one that we see probably sold the most often.
So that's the one that grows flat?
Yeah, it's almost like a ground cover.
Okay.
And that may or may not be the one that you have, but there certainly are other cotoneasters that'll get 10 feet tall. I mean, they're more like a big shrub. So
okay.
You kind of have to look at what cultivar you are, and maybe if you still have the label or something, you might
yes,
be able
I
to
do.
See. Yeah, you might be able to see which size
right.
you ended up
and
with.
Will they grow against the wall?
I see no reason why they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and do I feed them?
You know, they're one of those that I wouldn't worry too. Probably the first few years or something, you might want to fertilize them in spring. They're not ones that I would say need a lot of fertilizer or have any really big nutrient deficiency problems. So,
okay. And can I cut them shorter? Can I just prune them?
Sure, you can.
Okay.
I would do, just like with most shrubs, I do some light pruning. Now, if you want to do major pruning, I'd probably wait until spring.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Sure. Thank you. Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry we have one person we can't take, but Sandy will be back next month. In the meantime, by the way, on our companion station, WYLL Television, every week there's an opportunity to ask questions about gardening. You tune into the show Illinois Gardener. That's Thursdays at 7. And Sandy would like to mention?
Real quick, the Champaign County Garden Walk is coming up this June 25th. It's a Saturday, something a little bit different. And you can get tickets at most of the area garden centers, or you can call our office at 217-333-7672. So June 25th for the Champaign County Master Gardeners Garden Walk. Always a good time.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sandy Mason, she's horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She's here once a month. On a Tuesday, we talk about lawn and garden care. The program's here made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom-designed gemstone round tables and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Of course, the money to support this station also comes from listeners, and we are right now raising the money we will use on next year's programming. By June 30th, we must meet and exceed our $850,000 member support goal. And as of today, we have raised around $770,000. So we're close. But with your help now, we can actually close that last gap and raise the money we need. You really, truly can make a difference. You can call us right now at 217-244-9455 and make a contribution using your credit card. We accept MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and American Express. Again, the number, 217-244-9455. And thank you. We will take a break. We'll have some news from National Public Radio and also an update on the market, so stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety.